And Nicholas I also informed him, according to Pushkin's account of these discussions, that it was time for him to stop, in Nicholas's words, playing the fool. That's how Nicholas saw all of this political dissidence. And to ensure that Pushkin behaved, he was, after all, beginning to be too important a poet to allow to be an outsider, Nicholas declared that he would personally be Pushkin's censor. In fact, he was assigned a special official under the close watch of the Tsar, but he was so much an insider, but also so much a problem, that Nicholas declared he would be his own private censor. The results of this relationship were rather mixed. On the one hand, Pushkin did begin to stop playing the fool in some respects. His writings often praised Russia and its rulers, especially Peter the Great, who he greatly admired, but even occasionally the reigning monarch Nicholas I himself, which earned him great condemnation by some of his friends and other liberals. How dare he praise this horrible tyrant? Nonetheless, Pushkin also continued to write politically critical poems not for publication that would be distributed among his friends. In fact, even some of his greatest works, such as the epic poem about Peter the Great called The Bronze Horseman, named after the statue Catherine built in bronze to him on Senate Square in St. Petersburg. Even this was a work, as were others, were filled with subtle and not so subtle warnings about the dangers of unbridled political power and arrogant political will. This poem in particular is about a great flood, indeed the very flood of 1824 that so troubled Alexander I, and about a suggestion of how even with mighty power one cannot control everything, such as the elements. And when an ordinary man suffering in this flood curses the statue of Peter, he rises up off his great pedestal and chases this poor man through the city. A darker image of Peter I, it seems, emerging. There's even some evidence that in these years, Pushkin asked Nicholas's permission to leave the country, to emigrate and move to Western Europe, to flee, as it were, not for his Africa, but for his Europe. To go to the West, Nicholas I refused. And there are stories and evidence in the archives that he asked more than once to be allowed to leave the country. How do we make sense of all these contradictions? One view, the view offered by Soviet scholars, is that the true Pushkin was a rebel, a complete rebel, a Decembrist at heart, but had to pretend to be a loyalist in order not to be sent to Siberia, in order to protect his freedom, to allow him to write and even to publish. Another way to look at it is that both faces of Pushkin were true, were honest, that he was both a loyalist and a rebel, just as he was both a Russian and an African, both an aristocratic insider and a troublesome rebel. In other words, ambivalence was the ground on which he most often stood. And one could suggest that this very uncertainty was characteristic of what it meant to be an educated Russian in Russia of Nicholas I's reign. Now, to more fully understand Pushkin's peculiar identity and, most importantly, his place in his own time, one has to look a little bit more closely at Pushkin's style, his manner of living and writing. For Pushkin, one of the highest values was play. He loved to play. It pervaded everything he did, was central to his personality, and indeed, it should be said, was increasingly part of the westernized culture of 19th century Russia. In the lycée, in the school where he attended at Tsarskoye Selo, he had a reputation as a very creative young man, but flighty, foolish in some ways. Remember Nicholas I's comment about him. In fact, his best subjects were dancing, fencing, literature, and French. As a government official in St. Petersburg, as we've seen, he reveled in the pleasures of high society, as did many aristocratic and upper-class Russians of the time. He loved balls. He loved the ballet. He loved drunken parties with his friends. He loved to gamble, as so many of his class did, and in fact lost thousands at cards, soon going very deep into debt. And especially, he often said, he loved women. For example, he wrote in 1819 to a friend that two of the greatest things about living in St. Petersburg were champagne and women. And even better, he said, In Petersburg, there's plenty of both.